Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Hi, I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and welcome to The Miracle Within You, the show at the intersection of psychology, medicine, and spirituality that considers how the mind and body interact with each other to influence health and healing. With years of experience as a practicing psychologist in the health and wellness fields, and as a writer covering amazing stories of healing, I will explore with my guests how numerous factors influence our lives and our health. Thank you for listening.
Hi, and welcome to this edition of The Miracle Within You. I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and today I'm delighted to have with me as a guest, Asim Salah. He is currently living in Washington, D.C., but he is a great humanitarian who works really around the world, originally from Sudan. And he's got a very interesting story to tell. Asim, great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Dr. Howard. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And so, you know, the only set question that I have for people is just give us a bit of background of what you've been doing, how you got to be here, and then we'll transfer and talk about your health issues and how you dealt with it.
Yeah, sure. So I born and grew up in Darfur in Sudan. And it's a tough place, to be honest. Like, it's a tough place when it came to environment issues. We have like drought, sometimes we have floods, we have all these natural disasters, and always accompanied by like conflicts and war and all this kind of things. So I'm a product of a war, or you can say conflict zone. And I lived my entire life over there, and I believe that this is how life is. We don't have electricity, we don't have internet or connections with the world or everything, or even newspapers. So I just thought, just like, oh, this is like how it is everywhere. And I remember in when I was like 5 years old, we have a famine, like because of the drought in our area. It's affected like West Sudan, Chad, and Central Africa, and it was a big problem. At that time, NGO and international non-governmental organizations is not like very active, like right now. And so due to the crisis, President Reagan at that time, this was in 1984-85, he deployed some troops, US troops there, in order to respond to the crisis and to help with that one. And it was really massive, it was really big. And I remember those troops, actually, they came and they have the logistic compound in front of our house, because we have this massive open land in front of the house. So I used to sit there for entire day just looking at those soldiers and what they do, and I saw that they like have these big trucks, and just like they open and they have all these tools, and they try to repair the other cars, and there's helicopters and all these kind of things. And one of the things that I remember very well, due to the famine, so a lot of people they migrated from Chad and from Central Africa and from other part of Darfur to our area, because our area was a little bit good. And it was so harsh for the local people, to the limit that the mothers, while they're walking toward our our city, they reach a point that they cannot carry their babies anymore.
Mm.
So it was so bad to the limit that they just leave their babies on the bush, on the open land, and because they can't carry them anymore, and they just leave them and they walk. So the U.S. troops, they used to have this search and rescue, so helicopters, and they go and look for those babies, and they bring them. So when they land, they land in front of our home, actually. Like, I used to just sit there and watch, and then they try to unite them with their mothers.
Oh my.
So it was something great. And I was like only 4 or 5 years old at that time. And in a moment, I remember very well, I was sitting. I even remember the store or the rocks where I was sitting on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just closed my eyes and I wish, just like, God, I really want to do this one day.
Mm.
Like, I want to become as like those people and try to help other people. And then, yeah, the crisis is gone. I forgot about it and I forgot about my wish. But somehow it seems the universe was listening to me at that time. In a way that I did not even plan, I ended up actually working in humanitarian sectors and trying to help people. Also united babies with their moms and trying to help the people, like, to survive the pain and the suffering that they have and cross to the line to the safety and to ensure that actually they continue their life and all that kind of things. So I believe we have our own plans and based on whatever, because when I was there in that isolated area, like I could call it actually uncivilized area, right? Because mm-hmm. we have nothing connected with civilization or what's going on in the world. My entire dreams and everything, I was limited actually to the environment around me. I want to just study a little bit, graduate my high school, be a soldier, carry a gun, because like if you are a soldier and you have a gun, just like you are respected by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But the universe has another plan for me
mm-hmm.
somehow. And it's just things work out with me in a way that I never believed it. Like I never planned for any of it. The only thing that just like every time there's a change in my plan, I just try to sit down and I think about what happened and how can I adapt myself and move on. I always look at the bright side and move on. From yep. Darfur, I end up in the capital of Sudan. And for me, capital of Sudan, Khartoum, which is not a big deal, but for me, it was like New York. The electricity, the lights, the cars, all these kind of things, like something that really excited me. And just like, I will never forget that. I arrived like around 4 o'clock in the evening. And I, at that time, like we have in Sudan, just this was in, like in 1998. Mm-hmm. And we just had like the landline. So we had in our village, one landline in the entire village, in one of the shops. So you call and the shop, owner, like you call the shop owner, just like, hey, I want to speak to my family. And the shop owner just like, okay, give you 10 minutes. They kind of go and just like call the family. And then the family come back. And then I speak to them. And of course, they charge them money per minute, like just like how long it took from them to talk. And I would never remember the first time like I went to the capital in 1998. And I was like so surprised with all these things. And it was like around 7 o'clock in the evening, I called the shop to call my mom and my family, and they came. And I told my mom, just like, listen, yeah, you guys, you are wasting your life.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, this is a miracle. These guys, they have electricity, just like these cars. So I was so fascinated by that. So Khartoum, capital of Sudan, when you compare it with New York, is nothing. And at that time, I remember, like, I consider it like, for me, it was like New York. And so anyway, things work out without me planning. The war and the conflict is continuous in Sudan. Like there is a war between North Sudan, South Sudan, in Darfur and Sudan, and all these kind of things. And due to that, I end up into some troubles with the government because I'm from Darfur, and Darfurian people, they were fighting against the government because they think that the government, they are not spending enough for the area development. So I get into trouble with the government, and somehow I end up in Europe, and I granted like a protection in Italy. It's something that I never, like my entire life, like I never thought about, like just like going to Europe or even to leave one day outside Sudan.
Right.
And suddenly I found myself in this in Europe, in West, and just like, and then I get so shocked with the culture, with the people, with the technology, with everything around me and all these kind of things. And yeah, and even though it wasn't easy, because I remember like when I arrived to Italy, and I will never forget, it was January 15th, 2003. So it's like 2004. So I was there, and just like there's a guy supposed to meet me, so like to finalize the procedures and also the other things like residence and all these kind of things. So he took me to the immigration, and we did the fingerprint. And then when he finished, he told me, we went out from the immigration office, and he just told me, just like, okay, good luck. So imagine like me, someone coming from Sudan, doesn't have like any connections in a country, doesn't even speak the language and everything. I'm just, we end up like in I end up in the street, and that is, I don't know anybody, I don't know how to talk to people, I don't know any type of things. Anyway, but I survived that, and I was looking for a job. It was in Italy, and I tried, and I couldn't find a job in Italy because of so many reasons, including like just like, okay, this guy, we don't trust him, even though like I have a good qualifications, I have my bachelor degree, I have a good experience in Sudanese Air Force and all these kind of things. So I couldn't find a job, and finally I said, okay, let me look for international job. And I was looking, and I applied for a position for an organization called MedAir. And just like, okay, that's great, MedAir. So that probably is medical air evacuations or something like that. So someone coming from the Air Force, I know a lot about air operations, and just like, okay, this is great. And the position was in Afghanistan, so I applied for it, and I was waiting to hear from them, and they just called me back like after a couple of days, and they told me just like, yeah, you know, yeah, we really fascinated by your experience and all these kind of things. You have to be committed to our values, and one of the values you have to be Christians, and also you have to commit to pay half of the return ticket between Italy and Afghanistan. And literally, I was like a homeless at that time. I used the computers and all these kind of things because a friend of mine, an Italian guy, his name is Alessandro, we just met on the street, and he was very kind, and he allowed me to come to his home at any time, and he can use the computer, and he tried to help me to integrate with the culture and with the people, and giving me access to internet and the computers. And so anyway, I said to myself, if I can't commit to airfare or half of the airfare to go to Afghanistan, I wouldn't be sleeping in the street tonight. At least I would be sleeping in a room. But so I can't. So I just told them, just like, no, I can't, and sorry for that. And yeah, but the same platform that I found the positions, I start looking around, and I saw this, so many international positions, and I saw one open vacancy, and it was exactly like for me. It's like tailored to me. Someone with the Air Force background, or he has or studied air operations, or ex-pilot, or something like that. They were looking for air operations. So I applied for that position, and just it happened that just like, okay, they immediately actually, the following day, they sent me an email and just like, oh yeah, we are very interested and want to talk to you. And I did. And it was one of the international NGOs that actually, they don't pay a lot. They use people as volunteers, and they pay them like some money for their livings and food and all these kind of things. And they give them like a little bit like pocket money every month. But that pocket money for me was like everything, because I was like a homeless, like I don't have anything. So I went through the recruitment process, and then just like, okay, that's good. So you are hired, and before we deploy you for any missions, we're gonna send you for a training, because they asked me, do you know about us? I just like, listen, yeah, I don't know anything about you. I know how to do what I do. I know my job very well, but I don't know anything about you or what you do, or even this sector. Like I'm not familiar with it at all. They say, no, you are good. And we, or they have some trainings and stuff like this, like before deployment. So I supposed to go, so to be familiar with the sector in general and what they do, and also about the organizations and their values and all these kind of things. Just like, okay. And that was like in early December 2004. And so a couple of days or a few days later, tsunami 2004 happened. Mm. It hit very badly Indonesia, Thailand, and all these kind of things. And so all the NGOs, they deployed their teams over there. And I was one of the people that had been asked, just like, okay, to be deployed in that area. And I called the organizer, just like, listen, yeah, you told me that before I started this sector, I need to know a little bit more about you and about the sector, and there's some trainings I'm supposed to do. I did not even start. He's like, no, you're going to be fine. So I had been sent there to tsunami 2004, and I was one of the first responder actually arrived there. I arrived there 48 hours after the tsunami happened. And it was a shock. And it was, I responded exactly to Banda Aceh. It is a city in North Sumatra in Indonesia, Sumatra Island. And so yeah, I went there, and then I saw the disaster and how that tsunami actually impacted the city. Banda Aceh is a big city. The tsunami wiped out the entire city. There is no a single home is intact. Wow. Everything had been destroyed, except there is one hotel, one supermarket I will never forget, and there is a mosque. Those are the only three buildings that they were standing. Imagine an entire city had been wiped out, and everybody in that city died.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Bodies everywhere, on the street, bodies on the wells, everywhere. And it was a big shock for me. I say I'm coming from a very harsh environment, and I just like, I'm a child, war child, and I'm familiar with this, but I shocked what that happened. Everybody alive I met from that city, actually, he was out of the city that day. Mm-hmm. There's no a single survivor. I don't know even the numbers, how many people they died. So
yeah,
we all shocked, all the responders, the teams that we arrived there, were shocked. We don't even know where to start, what to do. And for me, it was like a big thing. That is what my first missions. And I remember, like, we sit down, like, all the NGOs, and we have this, like, coordination meeting, just like, okay, guys, there's health, there's agriculture, there's, I don't know, women protections, all of them, they were there, and they're thinking about just, like, what are we supposed to do? And finally, by the end of the day, the meeting was concluded, like, first of all, we need to clean up those bodies. So we start, all of us, like these volunteers from Indonesia. They have like emergency and civil service from the country also. They had been there. We all, the international, were there, and we all collaborated together just to clean the bodies, first of all. And it was real shocking, yes.
I'm sure it was. And that was the beginning of your long humanitarian career, amazing career. We'll hear more about it. When we come back after this short commercial break, though, we'll hear about some of your own physical challenges that you've had to deal with, even as you're providing this humanitarian aid. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
And welcome back to The Miracle Within You. Today I am with Asim Saleh, and he is a humanitarian. He comes from Sudan. He was telling us about the beginning of his humanitarian journey, incredible story. But he also has a personal journey, of course, along with us, that does border on the miraculous. So, Asim, tell us a little bit about that health journey you had.
Yeah, so it started from there, from Indonesia. Like, I continue, like, working in that sector, because it's not just about my job or what, or the benefit, or what the people that I help. It's also, it reminds me always, this is my people back home, and I start continue like that. And going on a mission after mission, a mission after mission, and I end up in 2016 in Iraq, and it was very interesting mission. We needed actually to open the humanitarian corridor in northeast Syria. And where I say open the, it's not like just open the corridor, it's like, there was landmines had been planted by randomly by ISIS in the entire northeast Syria, and especially the access from Iraq to northeast Syria. So our job, like, just like to go there, try to clean up that landmines. So during that mission, we used to actually had, we used to be based in Erbil, North Iraq. And then we go there frequently, drive all the way to the borders, and then we cross to the ISIS area. There's so many conflicts. Sometimes we get into clashes and have to fight with ISIS and all this, and then come back to Erbil. And there was so while doing that, one day I was in the guest house in Erbil. After we finish our work and we come back, and I remember the following few days, it's supposed to be a holiday, Eid al-Adha. So I was just there, like, with my colleagues, and we were just chatting about the mission, the life, and all these kind of things. And we end up, like, discussing things until, like, almost 11 in the night. 11 p.m. and then everybody went to their home or to their rooms, because we have curfew and all these kind of things. So shortly after I went to my bed, I start, like, feeling this coughing, like, suddenly, and I start coughing and just increasing, and then suddenly, like, just like, what's wrong? And I wanted to spit out, and just like I tried to do that, and it was very hard for me even to get out of the bed and to walk to the sink in the bathroom and try to spit out. But after few cough and fighting with that situation at that time, and I managed to do, and the minute that I spit on the sink, I realized what's going on. So my spit was reddish pink. And it was very well mixed with my, like, the sublab very well mixed with my spit. And from what I studied, from what I know, I had this like some heart issues for sometimes. So I'm a little bit aware of that. So when I look at the speed, immediately I realize that actually I have a heart failure. So yeah, so I fight it that night. Because I know there's a curfew, so there's no one allowed to move or anything. So I managed actually to survive. I have some medicine like Lasix, which is good for heart failures. I used to just have them as a backup, so I used them. And then the following morning, I tried to contact my colleagues and living in the same villa, and also some of our Iraqi colleagues, in order so they can take me to the hospital or to the clinic or a specialist or anything. But because it was a holiday, it was Eid al-Adha, and Eid al-Adha is like a big thing in Iraq. They close down at least for 3 days, even hospitals and clinics, they don't work. So sick people, they just have to wait. So anyway, I asked for, we couldn't make an appointment or anything during those 3 days, but then I survived because my colleagues, I asked them, okay, can you get me more Lasix? Because it's good for heart failures. And can you get me some antibiotics for the pulmonary, the lungs and all this kind of thing. So they did. And I'm not a doctor, but I felt so proud, because I know a little bit about this. So I really wrote a prescriptions for them to bring so I can survive that moment. And 3 days later, I had an appointment with a cardiac specialist. I went in the morning, and I had some exams like echoes, ACGs, and some breast and workout and all this just to find out on things. And then they asked me to come back in the afternoon. When I came in the afternoon as a doctor, he told me you have chronic heart failure. And then he started chronic heart failure. What does that mean? And he explained basically your heart failure and failing and it's going to be fail and you don't have a long time actually to live, maximum 2-3 months and you would be dead. And the only thing that I would advise you, actually, if you have a family, so you go back to your family and just spend the rest of your days with them until your death comes, because nothing could be done for you. And I was really shocked and just okay, this guy must be out of his mind. But he's in Iraq and he's they're away also from the first world. He's just out of mind. But I will try to seek that opinion more. So anyway, at that time, my family, my wife and my son, they were living in Iraq. So. Sorry, in Poland, Warsaw. So I decided to fly from there. So I managed to fly from there and go to Poland. So my wife, she's a U.S. diplomat at that time. And so with her connections, she tried to contact all the big cardio specialists in the U.S. and tried to find the way to look into my conditions. I contacted my doctor in Italy and he asked me to do some tests and I sent it to him. And also my organization at that time, based in UK and our insurance in UK also, through their insurance, so they contacted the biggest specialist in the US. And then I was in Warsaw also trying to check. So imagine I have doctors from Poland, Italy, and UK, and the US, and all of them, they confirm the first initial diagnosis from the doctor in Iraq. I have chronic heart failure. In fact, my heart is working only something around 25-27%. And they even wondering that I can walk. I supposed to be in bed and I supposed to just waiting for my time to die. It's and all of them the same thing. They came in fact, you don't even have 3 months, maybe 2 months tops. and you would be dead.
What was your reaction to that? I mean, I know initially you had doubt about the, you know, the first doctor, perhaps he wasn't as well trained and blah, blah, blah. And then you go and get, you know, numerous from first world countries, and they all say the same thing. What was your, how did you react to that?
Yeah, it was, I was really shocked. So first of all, like I was only 36 years old.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I never thought that I had these kind of problems, and I have plans and my kids are young and all these kind of things. And I never thought about like my life ending and all these kind of things, and enjoying life and doing all these kind of things. So I was really shocked. And then they saw much, like, I don't know, I was angry. So definitely it was real, because it can't be all those doctors are wrong and I'm right. So yeah. That is the first thing. So due to my nature, it's like always like try, okay, this is the situation, accept the situation first.
Right.
Look at the bright side.
Yeah.
So I accepted the situation. Like, okay, all of them, they came with the same diagnosis. I have only a few weeks, maximum top 8 weeks, and I will be gone. So what is the bright side?
Mm-hmm.
There's no bright side.
No.
Yes, because the bright side, when you have a tomorrow, when you have a future, when you that, what do you think about it?
Right.
Just like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna do this in 2 years, and I'm gonna be here in a decade, or I'm gonna retire in this place. But the thing for me, just like, this is an imminent death. So that is it. 8 weeks, you take it. You can't even, like, that is it. You can take it. There's nothing. And trying to explore some options, if there's any way we can fix this, all this kind of thing. So I was like, really, at the beginning, I was just shocked. And I was so motivated by finding a solution, actually, to how to survive this situation.
That's the key. Right.
Yes.
You were not put off and said, "Oh, okay. Well, that's I only got a few weeks left." You said, "I'm gonna get past this, and I'm gonna find the answer." Right.
Exactly. But it's not like my work, because in my work, when we face a challenge,
right,
I try to think, I try to consult, to have a meeting with others, and go for work. No, this is like specialist doctors. So the decisions or the thought process is not in my head. It's there. So I have to depend on them and what they say. So I went back, just like, okay, so guys, yep, I have 8 weeks. I accept that. I understand. How can I get out of this situation? So all of them, actually, my doctor in Italy, he said, "I wish you all the best. I'm out." So yeah, the doctors in the US, they say the only way actually to have a heart transplant. And a heart transplant, and they have, like, I remember they have an admin person like in that meeting and the Skype calls, and who are describing or telling me what is the process of that and this kind of thing. So I have to pay more than $500,000, and then just like in order just to put me on the list. Yes, and then it's not guaranteed, because it's not even up to them. It's right. Up to, like, can they find the right person with the right blood type, with the right body in order to fit my body and all those kind of things. So it depends. So first of all, I have to pay this. It's just to be on the list.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me check with the British. So I had the same meeting with them and the same amount of money, the same conclusions, like I have to do this. Okay. Let me check with the Polish.
Right.
The Polish, they told me, okay, let's give us some days, let me think about it and this kind of thing. So, okay. So anyway, that night, I had those meetings in one day. And that night, I went to bed and I was like, clear, I will do the heart transplant. And so I have a good insurance, they can cover this. up to $500,000. So the difference, we can do it. And like we were discussing this with my wife, she's like, don't worry, it's going to be fine. We can sell our house or whatever, and we can work this out. So I went to bed, and I was very optimistic that actually I will have a new heart and do it. Yes.
Okay, let's stop for this short commercial break and find the end of the story when we come right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to The Miracle Within You, and we are listening to Asim tell us his story, where he has been told he only has a few weeks left to live with very few options except a heart transplant. So, Asim, what happened?
Yeah, so that night I was just like thinking a lot. I couldn't sleep actually the entire night, and I was just thinking about the heart transplant and how's that work, and am I going to like be the same person if I get a new heart? What about the love, the emotions, the feeling? People, they always refer it to like they are in the heart and this kind of things. So if I get, is it a woman, is it a lady, am I going to be a feminine? Like if it is a lady, am I going to be, I don't know, if it's a criminal? So I have no idea. I always just have all this trail of thoughts on this kind of things. And I remember the stress and the pressure was so high because, like, I never thought I would be in this situation. Now I know, like, 100%, I'm going to die. So at the end, just like try to sleep, and I think like around dawn time, something like that, I managed to sleep for an hour. And when I wake up with a different decision. It's like, I don't want to do this. I did my best in my life. I tried to help people. I tried to help my family. I lived a good life. I have two sons and all these kind of things. Instead of cheating death, let me just accept in my own terms. Let me decide that I'm the one that when to die and how to die. So I'm going to do that. I'm not going to make that a favor for God or whatever. I'm just going to go for it. So the following day, I decided, and I had that decision from my family and my friends and everything. I just contacted the doctor. I told them, I'm out. I'm going to die. So yeah, but then, like, I start, yeah.
Yeah, so did you feel okay with that decision? Did that feel the right decision for you?
I actually was very relieved because, like, I feel very relaxed when I decided that, because my mind before that decision is always about like, okay, how can I survive? What am I going to do? Oh, so I was hanging on life so much, which like, so I was nervous and all this. But when I decided that, immediately, just like, I just feel relieved. Now I know my end days. That is it. Move on. So it was very comfortable. So immediately, I said, as I said, I hid that from my family, from everybody I know, except one friend. And he was with me in North Korea because just like, okay, this is what I decide. This is what I need to go. So I'm going to die in at that time, like it remained only like around 4 or 5 weeks. So just like, this is where I'm going to be buried. This is what I'm going to do. This is, and I have no regret at all. Like, we arrange all the funerals and the burials and all these kind of things. And we are, like, I was working for like 4 or 5 days, arrange everything. I even like we discussed, like, no need to send my body back to my country. Just like, it's easy. I don't want those hassles. So the only thing that actually occupied my mind is my children. Like, I'm not going to see them growing up, having grandchildren and all this kind of thing. And just like the other things, one of them at that time was 6 years, like 7 years old, and the other one was 1 year and a half. Those kids, they don't even know me. I didn't get the chance actually even to be with them. So I was always running around the world trying to help the people. So I couldn't dance. So that is the only thing that I have it. And it was like so like hard, and I feel so bad. But anyway, it is what it is, and I need to go with it. During that period, the doctors, even though I decided that I'm going to die, still they insisted for me to do some medical check and all these kind of things frequently. ECG, echo, blood test, all these kind of things. And why? Because they just want to follow the situation, see what is the end result and how that works. And one day I went for an echo, and the doctor, he told me, just like, asked me, just like, so what is the decision? Just like the decision, all those guys, they decided, like, I'm going to die or do a heart transplant. And I decided not to do a heart transplant. So he told me, listen, yeah, forget about all those people. The best heart surgeon I ever, or he ever known in his life is this guy. And he wrote his name in a piece of paper. It's like, he's a German Polish. He's most of the time, he's living in Poland. And I was lucky in that time in Poland. And just like, find this guy and listen to what he say. Whatever he say, that is actually going to be final. If he's telling you you're dead, you're dead. If you're telling this is a possibility. So I took that piece of paper, and he doesn't have his phone number or contact or anything. So I Googled his name, and immediately I found him, Dr. Andrea. And I found, like, he has like a small clinic. He's retired, he's not working, but he has a small clinic somewhere out of Warsaw, like around 1 hour drive. So I decided, I called the clinic, I made an appointment the same day, and I went to him and I told him, and he said, listen, yeah, go do another echocardiogram in this specific doctor and come back to me. So 3 days later, I was back to him with the new result. And he looked at me just like, yes, you consider yourself dead. There is no way out of this. Even heart transplant, I wouldn't even advise you to do it, because it's just going to be another issues, another complications, and how long you're going to survive. It's like, okay. But then he said, look, there's one thing. Yeah. I have something I want to try on you. Never been done on a human. And even is not permitted to do in a human. But if you agree, I can do it for you. If it works, I can guarantee for you, you're going to live long life, at least 30 years. And at that time, technology will change and you're going to be back. If it didn't work, you are dead anyway. And immediately, without any hesitation, I said, yes. She's like, no, go back, think about it, talk to your wife. She's like, no, listen. I have been talking to, I don't know how many doctors around the world, US, UK, Poland, Italy, Iraq, all these kind of things. You are the only one told me there's a chance of survival with my own heart. I don't mind taking that risk. And he told me, but it's going to be like 50-50. She's like, 50? That's great. It's like, no, it's not great. But anyway, so we decided to do that. During that period, of course, I have the acceptance that I'm going to be dead. Okay? And I'm trying not to raise my hope, like, a lot, if I survive the surgery. But if I survive, I need to change the way that I'm living. If I'm dead, I'm dead. Why? Because from that experience, what I learned is to look at the life in a different way. We living right now, we have a future. We have 1 year, 10 years, I don't know. We have maybe until we reach 90, 100, and that kind of thing. So we have a lot of time to think about it. But when you have 2 weeks, yeah, you don't have time to like future even to think about it. You are not going to be diplomatic to people because this person, maybe he get mad, angry, or hold something on you. You don't care. You just give it. Like, you, first of all, you lose all your filters, like being nice and diplomatic and all this kind of, just this kind of things. You start think about the real purpose of life, the ethics of life, the meaning of values, and all these kind of things. That's what that experience actually gave me, because I realized, like, I was living my life, I'm enjoying my life, but am I here actually really to enjoy my life? No, I'm going to be dead in 3 weeks. what did I leave or what I'm going to leave behind me? I don't have a legacy. I have nobody. Even my own children, they don't know me. If they grow up and become 18, 16 years old, and they ask their mom, who's our father is, like this, no, they don't know anything. I need, like, I, that moment, I decided, if I survive this surgery, I need to change my life, to be someone that really take the life or our purpose in life seriously. To think about life differently. Try to build a legacy, not to be famous, because if you are dead, fame is not going to help you. It's just about, like, be something or participate in the human development and all these kind of things. And yeah, guess what? I did the surgery and I'm here talking to you.
Grandpa, how many years ago was that?
That was in December 2016, so it's 7 years.
Yeah.
Almost. Yeah.
Incredible experience, and I know that you have indeed gone on from then and done some amazing humanitarian work around the world, so many different places. You've given yourself to humanity to save people, to improve their lives after you had faced death. And actually faced it pretty gracefully by saying, if this is it, this is going to be it. But when you did that, somehow this miracle emerged where you got cured. Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Exactly. Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely incredible, Asim. It's a wonderful story.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And yeah, I changed, of course. I tried to keep my my word after that, and I changed a lot. My wife right now, she called me, I become boring since then. And I'm not just boring, because I just look at things differently. And I have disagreement with many people in this life or with all world, because I had been there and I had been in that moment. And I don't wish to anybody actually to be in the same, like superiors as me, to realize life. But actually, when you go through that one, you know what's really life mean, and you just think about everything differently.
Yes. Yeah. And also, I think the perspective from which you came from, you know, you came from this third world country, you know, totally removed from first world country. And then you see it, and then you get involved in this humanitarian efforts, and this happens to you. Yeah, it's a remarkable story, and a lot of credit to you. It'd be interesting, I wonder, if you hadn't made that decision not to have the transplant, that may not have happened, right? You may not have run into this gentleman, and he may not have been able to fix you. And also, I'm sure your mindset was a big part of your healing. Now, before we leave, you have written a book about this extraordinary experience. Tell the audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, so through that, like what I had been through that experience, so I wrote a book, and the name of the book, Echoes of Fate, from heartbeats to the Echoes of Fate, from birth to the last heartbeats. Mm-hmm. And basically, I tried to write about that experience, not as a story. I tried actually to make it useful for people, to make that book actually an invitation to the people to look into themselves. They don't have to go through the same experience to learn about life and ethics and values and all these kind of things. They can just read that book. So I tried my best to make that book actually, yeah, as I said, invitations and urgency call to people to look into themselves and how they're living. And so far had been incredible. Like many people, they read that book and they told that, like, they make them think about their life and make them help actually to take the right decisions.
I'm sure that's true. That's Echoes of Fate by Asim, A-S-S-I-M-S-A-L-I-H. Available? Is it available on Amazon, bookstores? And
yes, it is available in Amazon and in all marketplaces.
Well, Asim, thank you on so many levels. First of all, for coming and talking about your experience, which I'm sure will inspire other people, but also for all the humanitarian and good work you have done around the world over these last, well, quite a long decades now, and since your recovery. But you know, I know that it involved many things, difficult circumstances, removing landmines and God knows what, as you mentioned. So thank you for your effort, and thank you for your story. And it's amazing, and long may you continue. And of course, now you know your kids too, right?
Exactly. And like, and thank you to Dr. Howard, and I'm really great, actually grateful to be here. Thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Miracle Within You. Join me next time when I continue to explore the power of the mind-body and how it can be employed to enhance health and healing.